A lot of news has come out of Alabama in the last year. From the nationally watched Senate race between Doug Jones and Roy Moore to the opening of the National Memorial for Peace and Justice in Montgomery, Alabama has taken a front row seat to some of our country's most central conversations and changes during the Trump administration. Our next guest is Imani Perry, a professor of African American Studies at Princeton and author of a recent piece in Harper's Magazine titled, As Goes the South, So Goes the Nation. By weaving political commentary, artistic analysis, personal history, and popular culture in this piece, Perry argues that while much can be said about the South's shortcomings, it is also an example of the kinds of change needed in the rest of the country, and that for every Roy Moore, there is a Randall Woodfin, the newly elected progressive mayor of Birmingham. I'm thrilled that she's able to join us today. Welcome to the show. Are you
Thank
with us, Imani?
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here.
Yes, I am.
And you're coming from a long distance. You're in Japan, no?
I am in Kyoto, Japan for the summer.
Well, we appreciate you taking the time. So start off telling us about where you were born.
I was born in Birmingham, Alabama, 9 years after the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing. It's several miles away in 1972. So, you know, sort of after the period of which Birmingham gets most attention, but still in the shadow of that history.
And you write about your own family's history in Alabama, stating, according to the 1910 census, we went from owned to owners before we went from illiterate to literate. Can you talk
Yes.
a bit about the importance of this history to understanding the complexities alive and well in Alabama today?
I think, you know, for me, if we think about after emancipation, the passionate desires of the formerly enslaved were to become educated, to own a bit of land, and to have access to the rights of suffrage. And those are kind of these repeated themes in the entire history of the Black South, but also specifically within my family. And so for me to kind of look into the past and to find the threads of those yearnings has been really profound.
And you write that Alabama calls up the past but is not stuck in the past. Do you think that there's a national perception
right.
that the South is stuck in time?
I think there is. I mean, I think that, you know, the only time until very recently you even would sort of hear the invocation of Alabama is either in terms of the kind of heroism of 1963, which is warranted, or the notion of Alabama as somehow backwards and behind. And in truth, you know, it's this incredibly rich cultural space in terms of the visual arts, in terms of music, in terms of a long history of struggle over, you know, racial justice, but also labor rights and the various kinds of yearnings that working people have had. And so I wanted to, you know, really push back against this idea of reading Alabama as a past and instead see it as a vanguard that is often a leader. If we think about all the movements that happened in the late 60s and the 70s, right, the heart of the civil rights movement also became an inspiration for other movements, from the feminist movement, for the gay rights movement, for, the late branch of the freedom movement that shifted to, you know, to Black power, all of these various things. So I like to, you know, I wanted to say, let's look not at Alabama as past, but let's look at it as potential harbinger of the future.
Right. Well, let's talk about the present and possibilities for the future. First, the National Memorial for Peace
yeah.
and Justice in Montgomery. We had Brian Stevenson on the show to discuss its creation back in May. What have been your thoughts about its importance and specifically its significance in a city like Montgomery?
I think that it's interesting because I've been recently, I was in Berlin and I was also in Hiroshima. And so I'm thinking a lot about memorializations. And they're a big part of how we as nations identify ourselves, right? So when we say that these things are important to remember, we're also saying something about our values. So the fact that, you know, there has been this investment in building an institution to remember those who died unjustly, who were murdered through a system of summary justice, of extra legal violence, that was an integral part of U.S. history.
Right.
I think it's incredibly important to talk about that. And that, along with the other recent civil rights museums and memorials in Jackson, Mississippi, for example, there's one that opened up last year. This is important for retelling the national story, particularly now when we run the risk of repeating so much of our horrors of the past.
You write in the piece about Randall Woodfin in his election as mayor. Tell us a little bit about him.
You know, it's, I think that he is exciting because he's a young progressive who is not sort of, you know, kind of towing the line of trying not to push too far in an area that is seen as sort of a more moderate or conservative Democratic area, and instead really trusted the people of Birmingham, and I think that was the right decision, as people who actually cared about, you know, the lives of the poor and the lives of the marginalized. I think, you know, he has a counterpart in Jackson, Mississippi with Chokwe Lumumba. It's a sort of a rising crop, and in Georgia with Stacey Abrams, of these, a rising crop of
right.
really politically progressive young black politicians or aspiring politicians who are, you know, who are willing to put their necks out, as it were, to be bold in their politics, and it seems to be bearing fruit.
But Woodfin, he is not the first black mayor of Birmingham, is he?
No, and in fact, you know, for me, it was quite moving to see his election because Richard Arrington, who was elected. He had been an academic. He'd worked with my mother at Miles College, a historically black college, and entered into politics and was elected the first black mayor of Birmingham. And really, was sort of remarkable both because he entered politics in response actually to police brutality. It was part of what generated the enthusiasm for his campaign. And he really rebuilt the economy of the city while maintaining progressive politics, you know, in the 1970s and 80s. So, you know, Woodfin, I think, echoes his election.
I'm D.W. Gibson speaking with Imani Perry about her article in the latest issue of Harper's called As the South Goes, So Goes the Nation. I want to also talk about the other election that got a lot more coverage, the campaign between Doug Jones and Roy Moore. What did that election mean to you? It almost, the way you wrote about it, almost seemed like a choice of a lesser of two evils.
Well, I wouldn't quite say a lesser of two evils, but I do think that, you know, Doug Jones made, I was glad he won. I had family members who campaigned for him, but he made clear pretty early on after his election that he really was hoping to appeal to, you know, the general electorate of Alabama, which is quite conservative and had Roy Moore not been quite so monstrous, perhaps. You know, I think of, you know, black voters really saved Alabama from electing someone who's, you know, just simply put, a heinous human being. And so, so Doug Jones was, to a certain extent, a bit, not perhaps not a disappointment, but certainly not someone who was willing to really kind of passionately stand up for the constituency that put him into office. And I think that that's a danger that we see repeatedly played out all across the nation with Democrats who notwithstanding where their base lies, are often trying to appeal to people who who don't necessarily have the best interests of their base at heart. And so, you know, this is a conundrum that we're going to face in November. We're going to face over and over again as sort of, you know, where does the party go, or where does this sort of spectrum from sort of liberal to left go from here? And, you know, I don't think that that's ultimately going to be the model that brings us to another a more healthy political landscape.
You also pull from several strands of history in your piece. I want to pack a few of them. You write about researching a famous photograph of a mother and a child standing outside a segregated movie theater. Why were you keen to unravel the backstory of this image and to find out where specifically it was taken?
Yeah, so it's interesting. It's actually an aunt and her niece,
uh-huh.
Although I thought it was a mother and a child.
That's
initially.
Right.
But I saw the photograph and it resonated with me so deeply because, it's 1956 Alabama, and yet even in the 1970s, the kind of attire, you know, the attention to detail, the lace, the layers, the sort of the sense of pageantry was so familiar to me, you know, what my sort of cultural identity was as a Black Alabaman, that it just resonated really deeply. And I also, someone who loved Gordon Parks' photography, it stood out to me because his photographs in Alabama are quite different from his other photographs of Black life. There is something, he captures that sense of sort of elegance and pageantry and, you know, the importance of formal presentation. And so he sees something that's so true about, you know, my home state, about the region. And that, it really was very meaningful to me that this incredible photographer could see with that kind of specificity. You know, it's very different from his Harlem photographs or even the ones in, you know, in his hometown of Wichita or in Chicago. You know, there's something, he gets something about the importance of elegance and physical presentation as a way of celebrating dignity. So I wanted to know the story of this photograph desperately.
Right. Well, and as I mentioned earlier, you know, you really have a lot of political commentary and personal history and popular culture weaved into the piece. With that in mind, why did you decide to write about Gucci Mane in the context of looking at Alabama as both disturbing and promising?
Well, because, you know, there's so much complexity to all people, and part of the point of the piece for me was to actually draw attention to the fact that so much of the complexity of Alabama is flattened. So it's both that it's held into the past, but the complexity of who Alabamans are is often flattened. And so that, you know, here, you know, this rapper who celebrates, you know, excess and jewels and, you know, extravagance and a kind of hood lifestyle is as much a part of what it means to be Alabaman as the sort of clean-cut, elegant, you know, trajectory from the civil rights movement to Mayor Woodson, that these are dimensions of the personality and the presentation of Black Alabama, and that they, you know, I don't think that the point is not to depict negative or positive, but actually it's a complex portrait of a people, and that for whom, the excess of Gucci Man is meaningful, as is, you know, the kind of fortitude of our history of protests. It's all a part of the fabric.
And what do you think it is about sort of our inability to see these complexities? Why do we keep this one-dimensional picture of Alabama in our minds, ultimately?
I mean, I think the easy answer is that, you know, Alabama specifically and the Deep South generally is treated as the repository for all that is shameful about the United States. I mean, and so for me, when I talk about in the piece, the landfills and the dumping that happens in Alabama and the toxic hazards, it's both literal, but also a metaphor for how the United States treats the South, that it's often seen as sort of the part that is shameful and dirty and backwards. And so it serves that narrative of sort of maintaining, to put it out over there. Right.
Well, you definitely brought the state to life, and I am grateful to the piece for that very much. I've been speaking with Imani Perry, a professor of African-American studies at Princeton, about her recent article for Harper's, "As Goes the South, So Goes the Nation."